Protests around the country continue as police departments struggle with systemic internal problems.
One of the deep, dark secrets of the police subculture is that there's a general fear of black men and boys, and that's what's at the root of all this.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, June 3rd, we take a big look at police departments and accountability for use of force. Then we break down the political power of police unions.
When they sit down with city officials to bargain for their collective bargaining agreements, they've been able to extract particularly strong protections for the police force.
Also, how Mexico is opening up its economy despite the high number of COVID-19 deaths. And we take a look at how minor league baseball teams are cutting hundreds of players from their rosters to save money in the pandemic.
You have a president talking about the Second Amendment as a use for people to come out here and use firearms against the people that are protesting. This is the messages that we're seeing. I don't know if you on social media because the news don't tell you everything. But you have to pay attention to what's going on.
Let's go. I will use my voice in the most uplifting way possible. And do everything in my power to educate my community.
Last night, protests in the name of George Floyd, a black man who was killed by a white police officer, continued around the country and around the world. In an attempt to quell the tension, some cities implemented curfews, which many protesters ignored. Other law enforcement officials attempted to show support for protesters by taking a knee or marching alongside them. But there were still numerous clashes between police and protesters, a clear example of just how strained the relationship between police and black people in this country has remained. In New York City, police officers were overheard on Tuesday on the citywide police scanner threatening physical violence against protesters.
We have a group of people blocking traffic on Albany and D Street. They're refusing to let the orange go eastbound on D Street and Albany. So we're stuck here.
Run them over.
Shoot them. Don't put that over yet.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we're exploring policing in the United States. And we start with a look at how deep the cultural biases are in police departments across the U.S. and what can be done to root them out. We're joined now by Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a former police officer. Phil tracks police misconduct allegations, and he's also the author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence, and weighed in for us on the police response to the recent uprising.
Well, keep in mind we have more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. And it's not just the large cities that are having to deal with protesters and demonstrations over the last week or so. It's small towns, it's large cities, it's suburban areas, it's pretty much everywhere. And I don't think that many law enforcement agencies understand the deep-rooted problems that are giving rise to so many people of so many different walks of life wanting to get involved and wanting their voices to be heard and wanting to get out in public and share the moment with their friends and their neighbors. The problem is when we all watched that video last week, the 8 to 10 minute video where Mr. Floyd was killed in front of our eyes, it was troubling on many levels. And one of the concerns is that people of all walks of life look at that video, and that if they haven't experienced being roughed up by the police, being beaten up by a police officer, being treated with a heavy hand by a police officer, they may well know somebody who has been treated that way. And it's touched so many lives that people have just had enough. They think we see this over and over again. And the fact of the matter is these types of incidents where police officers manhandle somebody, where they rough somebody up, where they use too much force gratuitously, happen every day across this country.
So I want to break down a little bit more of that, because I feel like, you know, again, a lot of the images that I'm seeing are reminiscent of when I was covering the events in Ferguson after the death of Michael Brown and the moment that really Black Lives Matter catalyzed. and became, you know, really the head of what we were seeing in terms of protests around the country. What we're seeing now, I think, that's different, and I'm curious to know your thoughts, is that there are some police departments that have shown some solidarity, as we mentioned, marching with protesters. That feels new. Is it a PR stunt? Is it authentic? Is this PDs who've realized, you know, we really need to get our act together, and so we're going to march in solidarity? How do you assess those?
I think it's sincere, and I think it's from the heart. I think what's different in this incident is that in the past, when we've watched videos, when we've looked at photographs, when I talk to law enforcement officers across the country, often in past incidents, they will have an explanation. They'll say, well, you're not understanding the big picture. There's another side to the story. You don't know what we deal with on a daily basis. I'm not hearing that this week. What I'm hearing from law enforcement officers, from friends and former colleagues and people who've contacted me, is that everybody is absolutely dismayed and without words to explain it. It's not explainable. You can't rationally explain what happened other than it was a willful and deliberate act. It went too far. And it was troubling to other law enforcement officers because at some point, a few minutes into that video, one of the other officers who was on the scene there should have tackled the officer that had his knee in Mr. Floyd's neck and removed him. It was out of control. And the fact that the other officers just stood by, tell me, that's normal behavior, not to kill somebody, but to rough somebody up, to take it too far, to teach somebody a lesson. It was, frankly, a gleeful exercise of street justice. That's what we saw there. It was teaching Mr. Floyd a lesson so he wouldn't give them a hard time if they ran into each other in the future.
I mean, we've seen this happen before with the death of Eric Garner, again, on video, saying the same words that Mr. Floyd said, which is, I can't breathe. And in that instance, again, another loss, another death of an unarmed Black man for living his life. And so I wonder what it is that changed now.
Well, what's different about that incident, what law enforcement officers have told me, is that with Eric Garner, they were still trying to secure him. They were still trying to get him handcuffed, that they were trying to effect an arrest. Here, the situation is completely different. At one point, it seems like they had Mr. Floyd handcuffed in a police cruiser, and then he ends up handcuffed on the ground. He was no threat at all to the officers there in that video that we watched. And I think that's the difference, is that law enforcement officers looking at this video, they see a difference and they can't explain it. And they're starting to realize maybe there is a problem, even when they don't want to admit it. Maybe there's not a problem in their department, they say, but we get it. We're starting to get it. And I think that's what's happening. And that's what's different in this video. And people all across the country can tell you these aren't isolated events, but this one, law enforcement officers can't explain it away. They just can't. And that's the difference.
I mean, I would argue that they couldn't explain away Eric Garner either, but that would be, you know, for another segment of another show. You know, law enforcement in this country does have a history in some elements. They're often talked about as bad apples, right? Cops like the one who killed George Floyd, for example. But there are deeper systemic issues in law enforcement and police departments across the country that are tied to racism. What element here is about police training?
Well, as to the bad apple theory, we've gone way beyond that. You know, in the New York Police Department, the Mullen Commission back in 1994 thought that they had gotten rid of the bad apple theory and proved it wrong. I mean, this is not a few bad apples. This is the police subculture. This is normal police behaviors in terms of using too much force on a regular basis. It's not a situation of a few bad apples. You can't explain it that way. It's way beyond that. So it is an issue of training. It's an issue of supervision. And it's an issue of the socialization process within police departments into the police culture, or the police subculture, as I call it, on a local level. It's very complicated and nuanced because there are many levels here that have to be dealt with. There's no easy fix to the situation, but it's systemic. There's institutional racism in the criminal justice system, and there's certainly institutional racism in policing across the country. And I can tell you, it's complicated by the fact that the Supreme Court gives deference to police officers in street encounters. They've allowed racial profiling to occur without any accountability across the country. So there's so many different levels here. It's not an easy fix.
Let's talk a little bit about the systemic racism part of this. We know, for example, with Eric Garner, the move in question there was the chokehold that was used on Mr. Garner. Here at the Minneapolis Police Department, there was a neck restraint used by the officer who ultimately killed George Floyd. We know that data from the Minneapolis Police Department shows that 2/3 of the people who were put in neck restraints by police there are Black. Explain to us that tactic, and is it going to come under investigation as the chokehold did here in New York after the death of Mr. Garner?
Well, the data from the Minneapolis Police Department, I've reviewed it, and it's frankly shocking. There's 4 types of neck restraints that they document in their data, and the numbers are just very troubling in terms of, you know, African Americans who were subjected to these compliance procedures, if you will. And one of the most troubling ones was they actually have a procedure that allows an officer to render someone unconscious with a chokehold. And to me, that is just shocking. You know, I was a police officer for a few years, a very long time ago, and I can tell you when I was a recruit at the New Hampshire Police Academy in 1986, that certainly wasn't allowed. It was well understood then in my training that certain types of neck holds would be the application of deadly force. In other words, you don't do it unless you're intending to kill somebody to stop a threat in hand-to-hand combat. It's just, it's not acceptable. It's shocking. It shouldn't be allowed. And I think the problem here is that, you know, one of the deep, dark secrets of the police subculture is that there's a general fear of Black men and boys. And that's what's at the root of all this. It's just that police officers, for whatever reason, handle their encounters with Black males, African-American males, different than they do with anybody else.
Phil, I want to stop you there because I want to make sure we're being clear. We're talking about how police engage and handle their encounters with Black men and boys. Are we talking about all police, white police, multiracial police? Who are we talking about?
I'm talking about as a generalization. I don't want to say all police officers, but frankly, that really is what I'm trying to get at. I'm not saying some police officers, and I'm not saying it's implicit bias. It's way beyond that. We can't cure this and fix our way out of it with a few hours of implicit bias training. It's a deep-rooted fear that police officers are socialized into. And it, frankly, we see this with officers of color as well. It's part of their makeup as a police officer. It's part of the type of policing they do. Think about the fact that we're always dealing with wars, right? We got a war on crime. We got a war on drugs. Everything's handled as a war. And we send the police officers into their jobs every day as warriors. They don't live and work in the same communities. They typically live elsewhere. Their children go to different schools than the children in the neighborhoods in which they work as police officers. Their family worship at different places. They shop at different schools. They go to job as if they're going to war every day. And they really treat African-American males, men and boys, as a threat. They're fearful of Black men and boys.
Let's be clear that the police that we're seeing on the ground right now, again, not every single officer, but generally speaking, a lot of police departments around the country have heavy military gear. The police in this country have become more militarized. I mean, covering Ferguson, you saw tanks on the ground. There have been calls for the National Guard to come in. Has that affected the increasing militarization of police departments? Has that added to the increase in violence that we're also seeing with some police officers?
Well, you know, the militarization of police goes way back. It goes back well into the early middle part of the 20th century. It's not something that's new. And I want to be careful not to criticize some of the equipment law enforcement has at different agencies across the country, a lot of it with federal funding that's supplied, because there is a time and a place for some of that equipment to be used. The problem is, when do we take that equipment out? When do law enforcement officers use that type of equipment? And frankly, I think it's inappropriate this week to roll some of those tank-like vehicles out. It's just completely inappropriate. That's not the way I'd handle it. And we have seen, as you pointed out, some really positive interactions that police chiefs and county sheriffs and their officers and deputies have exhibited dealing with citizens this week at rallies and at protests. And we've seen them doing the right things. We see Erica Shields, the police chief in Atlanta, getting out and listening to people. That's really important. And it's something that law enforcement officers are not very good at. They like to tell people what to do. They like to bark out commands and orders, but they're not very good at listening. And I think we can learn a lot there.
Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Phil, thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.
We're trapped. They're shooting pepper balls at us. They've thrown out tear gas, flashbangs.
And there are many reasons why achieving police reform is so challenging in the United States. One of those is the role of police unions. In some cases, these unions have pushed back against reforms meant to increase transparency. In other cases, they've established collective bargaining agreements that make it difficult to hold officers accountable. And some have even increased their power by forming political action committees. Melissa Segura recently reported on the power of police unions. She's a reporter for BuzzFeed News and a fellow at the think tank New America. And she joins us now. Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the role that police unions play in terms of their representation of their officers and public officials.
What we have is a group of officers who rightly have access to the same worker protections that many unionized workers have. Police unions, however, are a little distinct from other worker unions that we've seen in that they have incredible political clout and also tremendous political fundraising capabilities, in which have given them much more leverage than we would see perhaps from a service cleaners or a maintenance workers union. And so what that has meant is that when they sit down with city officials to bargain for their various worker contracts, for their collective bargaining agreements, they've been able to extract particularly strong protections for the police force. Now, what that has meant in the case of what my reporting shows is that those protections have actually extended into what many will call not just worker protections, but sort of obfuscation, sort of ways to obscure transparency and accountability in many ways that have left officers like the one we saw on tape, Officer Derek Chauvin, without any sort of public accountability or transparency, despite the amount of power that they've been invested with in our communities.
So let's talk a little bit, because there's a lot of police unions, a lot of police departments, a lot of different negotiations happening around tables across the country between those unions and public officials. Let's talk a little bit about what you saw in Minneapolis specifically. What did the police department union negotiate for that you're suggesting may have kept this officer from, or his transgressions from, coming to light prior to George Floyd?
The Minneapolis Police Federation, which is the union representing officers like Derek Chauvin, have been particularly powerful. Their contract includes provisions that, for example, don't allow clear public access to disciplinary records. Now, Minneapolis is better in the sense that you're able to see a listing of those particular accused transgressions, but you're not able to see the substance of many of those. And so what that means in particular is that we as the public don't have any access substantively to what's happening.
Melissa, how old are many of the police unions? Are they all, 100 years old, or are many of them newer unions that are being formed right now?
We have over 18,000 different policing entities across the country. And so that means that we have sort of an alphabet soup of all of these different unions. And labor laws also factor in very complex ways in different parts of the country. So we're really seeing from major metropolitans, mid-20th century, you've got strong entrenched unions. And now we're seeing actually a push. And the irony is that a lot of this push comes from the right, that is historically anti-union, with the exception of police.
Melissa, there have been a lot of questions, particularly here in New York City, as we've seen Mayor Bill de Blasio, try to tackle growing outrage among New Yorkers towards what they say is, police brutality from the NYPD and sort of excessive force by the NYPD, and sort of, how de Blasio is really trying to toe the line. A lot of folks would say that's because of the police unions here. Why do police unions have so much power, particularly over public officials?
What we're seeing is a combination sort of the abstract and of the concrete. And what I mean by that is, in an abstract way, we see the built-in narrative that so many of us have heard for so long about the heroism of police. And so what that means is that a lot of times in the public perception, you have this incredible loyalty to the police and to what they need. I mean, obviously, they have an incredibly difficult job. No one necessarily argues with that. And what that means is that, you know, no one necessarily wants, no political official wants to say, you know, I've rejected what the police say that they need to be able to do their jobs. That's almost political suicide, just from an abstract perspective. But then when you marry that with the fact that many of these unions have set up political PACs, they are incredible political fundraisers as well, that have dumped thousands upon thousands of dollars into various campaigns. We've seen this specifically, for example, in San Francisco, where a public defender who came in on a reformer's agenda was seeking office, and the police unions across the state of California had combined to pour in $700,000 against his campaign. Now, that's almost as much money as the candidate himself had raised to come to office. Again, they're happening on a local level, and they're also happening on a national level, where they have essentially raised a ton of money, and many, many, particularly on the local level, they're afraid of not being able to match that political clout, both in terms of its symbolic nature and really in terms of its financial clout. It's just almost political suicide for many of those local officials.
I'm also curious a little bit about the presence of white supremacy within police unions. Is there any proof of that? And if so, how widespread is it, Melissa?
It's very difficult to say. Most of what we've seen has been anecdotal. For example, in Chicago recently, there have been the White Boys, which is recognized as a white supremacy group, and others like it showing up at police union events in that city. There is currently an investigation into white supremacy groups infiltrating parts of the Chicago Police Department, just for example. We've also seen this in another sort of more subtle way, and that's the concern that a lot of affinity groups who represent Black and Brown officers are sort of breaking off and forming their own unions that are meant in some ways, from what I've seen per the research, to not only protect themselves from a union from a labor perspective, but most particularly from the predominantly white unions that represent their own departments. And so I think that when you have those collective voices, though many of them are minorities within their own police departments, having to rise up and say, hey, we need our own collective voice to be able to even have a seat at our own table for our own union, that should raise some questions.
Melissa Segura is a reporter for BuzzFeed News and a fellow at the think tank New America. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In New York State, state legislators appear to have enough votes to overhaul one of the strictest police privacy laws in the country, a decade-old statute known as 50A. It's a measure that severely restricts the public from accessing police misconduct records. In the past week, its reform has been something that even two frequent foes, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, seem to agree on.
I would sign a bill today that reforms 50A. I would sign it today.
The legislature right now could repeal the 50A legislation, the 50A law that is holding back transparency in police discipline.
But with New York State lawmakers currently hammering out exact details, it's still unclear how far the 50A reform will go towards meeting growing demands for police accountability. For more on this, I'm joined now by Josefa Velasquez, state capitol reporter for The City, a nonprofit newsroom covering New York City. Thanks for being with us, Josefa.
Thank you for having me.
So 50A has been around since the 70s. That's the 1970s. But it's been used more strictly since the killing of Eric Garner by a police officer in 2014. What has a stricter interpretation of this law looked like?
So, as you mentioned, it's been around since the 70s, and its original intent was to basically shield and protect law enforcement when it came to testifying against possible criminal activity. But really, over the last 5 or so years, 50A has been interpreted in a much stricter fashion, which lets it be used to shield personnel records. And that practice, which has only really been in effect for the de Blasio administration since 2016, was put in place after police department lawyers decided that previously NYPD allowed the press and the public to informally review bare bones records of disciplinary findings against police officers. But the police department lawyers had decided that that was a violation of this 58 statute, which shields not just the disciplinary records and the personnel records of police, but also fire department officials and any sort of uniformed law enforcement.
I guess the question for a lot of people is probably, why would a law like this exist? I mean, these are public servants made to protect the public. So what's the purpose of having a law like this?
So initially it was to help shield personal information for law enforcement. We're talking about home addresses, any sort of identifying information that might make them a target if they did in fact testify against the witness. And initially, it hadn't been interpreted as strictly as it has been over the last few years, but it has really sort of morphed into a completely different animal. And Frank Padovan, who was the state senator at the time who helped pass this bill in the 70s, had previously said, you know, this wasn't what we were intended to do with all of this. We didn't mean to shield all of this information from the public. It's being misinterpreted by the courts. And so now there has been a renewed push to get this section of the law repealed.
What's behind that push? And because it seems, as we said at the top, Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio don't often see eye to eye on many things, but they seem to agree that this is something that has to happen. What's inspiring this push? And I mean, how far is it really going to go? What's it really going to change if it is repealed?
Right. So I think there has been a forced effort to repeal this law after the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. And it really comes down to the fact that the police officer involved in the George Floyd killing, reports there have said this officer has had previous misconduct allegations and use of excessive force. If that had happened in New York, we wouldn't have been able to see that. We would not have known that a police officer had previous interactions with the community where they have allegedly used excessive force against that. And that has really buoyed this entire push in New York, just because the records here are so strict. And at this point in time, I think it's too early to tell what exactly the reforms to 50A are. I think the mayor and the governor have sort of given themselves a wiggle room to figure out how the legislature will interpret this. Is it a full repeal of 50A, or is it repeal and replace 50A with something else? That could mean that personnel records are only released if there are allegations of misconduct or improper use of force against a police officer, or it could also mean anyone could have access to a police officer's disciplinary records or personnel records if they file a Freedom of Information Act filing against them.
I just want to ask, I'm assuming the police union is not in favor of this, is that right?
That's correct. They're very adamantly opposed to all this.
Thanks so much. Josefa Velasquez is a state capitol reporter for The City. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we asked you about your perceptions of the police and whether it's changing in this moment.
The police are dangerous to people of color, especially men of color, but women as well.
I generally have respect for police officers and the good job they, by and large, do. I imagine it is rewarding at times and also thankless at times. However, Mr. Floyd's death has made it all too clear that there are people doing that job because it gives them power and not because they want to help people.
I haven't had faith in the police since I was in college, and I realized just why they're there. They're just there to uphold white supremacist values and to keep the top 1% safe while the rest of us are basically on our own.
It's been like this since before my time, so it doesn't surprise me at all.
Thank you.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The United States and countries around the world are slowly beginning to reopen their doors for business despite the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. But some places along the U.S.-Mexico border never actually shut down to begin with. Under pressure from the U.S. government, many manufacturing plants, known as maquiladoras, remained open and in production during the pandemic. The Mexican government was slow to respond to the pandemic, despite more than 97,000 Mexicans testing positive for the virus and more than 10,000 deaths. And as the country reopens this week, these plants remain a virus hotspot. To help us break down why Mexico is reopening at such a critical time, we're joined by Natalie Kitroev, a New York Times correspondent who covers Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Natalie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So briefly, what was Obrador's response to the pandemic?
So Mexico was slower than other countries in this region to implement social distancing measures. And in the beginning, Andrés Manuel López Obrador was encouraging people to hug each other. There was a more of a blasé attitude than in other countries. Now, Mexico has quickly realized how serious this has become, and López Obrador has allowed, the health officials to really take the reins of the public response. But you are still seeing cases rise. We are not at a peak yet here. And this is a moment where this week the country officially reopened. So you're seeing the country going through some of the worst days of the pandemic at the very moment at which it is economically opening its doors.
So cases are continuing to rise in Mexico, we understand, and it's deciding to reopen anyway. I mean, we're seeing a lot of this happening even here in the United States. What's the risk here, Natalie?
Well, I mean, there's an obvious risk when you're talking about these maquiladoras near the border, where we have seen, as you said, that many of them have remained open and they have become real hotspots for contagion. You see in the state of Baja California, which is, includes Tijuana, 80% of the deaths. 80% of the deaths were maquiladora workers so far. So, these factories where folks are making hundreds of thousands of people in Mexico are making goods just for export are, risky. I mean, you have folks that are entering into massive plants where they're working closely. They're often touching the same tools. They go in and out of the same doors. And it became really dangerous here. I mean, to be clear, as you said, parts of the U.S. are doing this, and the government's justification is, look, it's not so bad everywhere, and we need to be able to open up parts of our economy. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to survive this thing economically.
Let's talk a little bit about the economics. Are these maquiladoras opening up because of economic pressure, because their biggest export basically is to the United States? Is there pressure from the United States here?
There's been a ton of pressure for weeks now. And you've had pressure from various different quarters of the United States. You've had pressure from the Pentagon. There's a lot of defense contractors here. There's a lot of companies that make, both aerospace and other military equipment. And so the Pentagon has said these are critical, but that means critical for the U.S., not critical for Mexico. The U.S. ambassador here has said, look, if you don't keep these plants open, you risk losing these jobs altogether. And that is a really scary warning here, right? Because a huge chunk of the economy in Mexico since the signing of NAFTA has been built up around supplying its northern neighbor. And losing these jobs would be a huge economic blow. You know, and you've seen manufacturers in the United States also put pressure on Mexico, saying, you know, our supply chains cannot function. We cannot function without you guys opening up. You see that with the car industry. I mean, a car crosses the border multiple times as it's being made. And you're seeing the codependence of the supply chains between these two countries really come to fruition right now.
What does this say about the U.S.-Mexico relationship, you know, particularly between López Obrador and the Trump administration?
Well, you know, López Obrador, in the, you know, as he was campaigning, you know, he wrote a book, you know, Oye Trump, that was kind of a, you know, supposed to be giving Trump some lessons about, you know, the Mexican experience. And he's a leftist. But since, you know, he's had the presidency, he has really sought to not create extra drama between him and President Trump. And what you're seeing right now is both that the López Obrador administration is trying to accommodate the wishes of its northern neighbor, but you're also seeing López Obrador, to be fair to him and to be fair to his officials, not just bending to U.S. pressure, but really considering what is happening inside their own country and what the economic risks are of shutting down completely. Because this is not the United States. You know, there is actually no big economic package coming for workers here. And so there needs to be some kind of lifeline, and salaries in many cases are the only lifeline available.
Talking a little bit more about the economics here, there was a huge strike wave last year in the city of Matamoros, where maquiladora workers were clashing with management. You've reported on this. You've spoken to workers in these facilities. Are they continuing to organize for better conditions despite or even, you know, during this pandemic?
The workers that I've talked to and reported on are the ones that have been organizing right now. I just arrived in Mexico, but I have spoken to more than a dozen workers who, many of whom participated in what were a wave of protests, you know, about a month ago outside of factories all along the border. And, you know, one kind of sparked the other. Folks were lining up outside their factories and demanding better protective equipment, demanding to be allowed to go home. This was really in the early days of the pandemic when, you know, things were really in flux. And the workers that I talked to were terrified of going to work, and they wouldn't normally be outside of their factory. It was kind of a rare event for them to be confronting so openly their bosses and these major U.S. corporations. And it really cannot be overstated the extent of the political influence of these companies here. You know, a company like Collins Aerospace, you know, is Honeywell. These are hugely important companies, and these workers were standing outside and refusing to go inside. You know, those waves, they are continuing to push back. But now, as Mexico formally reopens, you know, on June 1st, there's less leverage there, right? Because basically the president and the entire administration has said, here, you know, we are now open for business.
Natalie, do the workers at least have personal protective gear? This is something that a lot of businesses that are reopening, depending on where you are being mandated to provide for their employees, whether that be hand sanitizer, face masks, gloves, or face shields. Are these workers being provided with the equipment that they need to at least protect themselves if they're being forced to work anyway?
Yes, they are now. In the beginning of all of this, when I was talking to them, many of them were not being given even face masks. There was gel. There was, you know, hand sanitizer. But face masks were not universal. Now there has, you know, been a ramp up on the protective gear. I mean, I do not know whether in every factory, I mean, there are really hundreds upon hundreds of these factories, and they're not all brand names that you've heard of. And so, you know, it's not clear exactly how strictly every factory is following these guidelines, but certainly the government has made a point of saying, you know, there are protocols and these need to be followed. And, you know, we will see what happens. As we know now, these places can be really dangerous vectors of disease. So I think there's been a realization that this kind of equipment is not optional.
Natalie Katroev is a New York Times correspondent covering Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Natalie, stay safe, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
It's almost officially summer, but you won't be hearing the crack of a baseball bat anytime soon. The COVID-19 pandemic has kept most sports, including baseball, largely on hold. And the lack of revenue from ticket sales is forcing Major League Baseball teams to look for ways to cut costs. So far, they've set their sights on minor league teams to make that happen. When the pandemic first hit, Major League Baseball decided to pay the minor league players a $400 stipend. That expired May 31st, leaving many players with no paycheck and unsure if they'll ever play ball again. And these cuts could change minor league baseball for years to come. We're joined now by Garrett Brushhouse, an attorney for the ballplayers, a former San Francisco Giants minor leaguer, and co-founder of Advocates for Minor Leaguers.
So there's no baseball right now, though at the top, you know, the major league players are trying to work out a plan with Major League Baseball, although they are pretty far apart right now. I'm still hopeful and crossing my fingers that we'll see baseball sometime. But for minor league players, I don't think we're going to see a minor league season. They haven't officially canceled the season yet, but everyone is operating as if there will not be a minor league season. And what that means is there are thousands of minor league ball players out there. There are hundreds of minor league coaches and hundreds of other staff members and stadium workers who are wondering when their next paycheck is going to come. Minor league ball players in particular have it very hard because their salaries are so low to begin with. Most people are pretty surprised when I tell them what salaries are. Most people, you know, they assume that minor league ball players don't get rich, but they don't realize that many ball players make less than $7,500 for an entire year. And so they are only paid during the season. So that means that they came to spring training and they hadn't had a paycheck for several months. And then they aren't paid during spring training. And then they were sent home and they've been scrambling since then. And, you know, thankfully, you know, due to some advocacy and due to the efforts of some good people in the game, they've been paid a $400 per week stipend, but it was set to expire yesterday. And there were a lot of anxious people in the game, a lot of anxious minor leaguers wondering what was going to happen when June 1st came around.
I had no idea that they made that little, first of all, per year. You mentioned that there's been some financial relief that's come their way in the form of this $400 a week stipend. But I imagine there have also been players who have been let go. Is that right?
Yeah, there have. You know, last week was a really bad week for minor league baseball. It started with the A's early in the week. They announced that they would no longer continue that $400 stipend. And so for those Oakland Athletics minor league players, they were told that, hey, you need to continue your training, but we're no longer going to pay you at all for that. I talked to many Oakland Athletics minor leaguers who felt betrayed. The Oakland Athletics, like a lot of teams, use the word family a lot, and this is not how you treat your family. And the ironic thing is that for those Oakland A's players, they're probably going to apply for unemployment benefits, and it's going to be up to the taxpayers now to provide those players a lifeline instead of the billionaire owner of the A's, whose family owns the Gap brand of clothing companies. Aside from the Oakland A's, there were other teams that did decide to continue paying the $400 per week stipend, although some decided to reduce it some decided to only commit to pay it for one more month. But in the process, some of those teams cut 25% or more of their minor league players last week. And so for those guys, they've essentially been fired, and that was a big portion of their workforce. There are hundreds of minor league players who are now out of work, who face a very tough economy. when they're trying to find new jobs. And for most of those players, their minor league baseball career is probably over. And the only thing on their resume is baseball, and it's going to be a very tough transition for those guys.
Our producer, who was putting this segment together, noticed a tweet by Sean Doolittle, who said that the Washington Nationals players will be pooling their money to continue to pay their minor league players the stipends that you mentioned, the $400 a week stipends. Do we know of any other teams that are taking similar approaches?
Yeah, you know, there have been some wonderful major league players that have stepped up and filled that void. And Sean Doolittle is one of them. He is, you know, one of the most amazing people in baseball. And he is a person who really has empathy and really cares about other human beings. And, you know, he doesn't just speak it. He actually walks the walk, too. And there are some other major league players that have done similar things. Adam Wainwright has donated enough to give $1,000 to every minor league player for the Cardinals. There's been a player for the Texas Rangers that has done something similar. David Price for the Los Angeles Dodgers has decided to do the same thing for Dodgers minor league players. So you do see some major league players stepping up, but you know what other people point out is, you know, why should it be up to, you know, the major league players to do this? It's the major league teams that are employing these minor league players. And even in the case of the A's are still employing those A's minor leaguers. They actually reminded those minor leaguers in the email that they sent to them that, hey, you are still under contract. You can't go and play anywhere else. You need to keep training for us. And so a lot of people point out that it should be those teams that are taking care of these players, not the major league, not the major league players.
Garrett, this is just one segment, so we can't delve into the entire history of minor league baseball here, but I'm curious, the coronavirus pandemic has brought to light inequities that have long existed, have predated the virus itself and the pandemic. I'm wondering if you could give us some insight into, I mean, this doesn't just happen in a vacuum, right? The fact that these minor league players are either getting paid, you know, extraordinarily low salaries or not getting paid at all, you know, where is that coming from historically before the pandemic? What role did the minor leagues, what was the relationship like here? Because it feels like a little bit punitive almost to these players.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, what you're seeing in the midst of a pandemic is structural imbalances are becoming exaggerated and exacerbated. And in the case of minor league baseball players, there's no representation at the bargaining table. The major league players have a very powerful union, the Major League Baseball Players Association. It's been around since 1966 when Marvin Miller got the major league players together. Then 2 years later, they achieved the first collective bargaining agreement in the history of major sports. But the minor league players have never unionized. And that's in contrast to minor league hockey, which does have a union. And minor league hockey players make much more than minor league baseball players. And so what you're seeing in the midst of a pandemic now is you're seeing those structural imbalances really come to light. And just like with other workers across the country, if you don't have representation, it's very easy for ownership and management to take advantage of you and to implement things that maybe were already in the works or, you know, at the least, simply cut you instead of somebody else that does have representation. And so in the case of minor league baseball, there was already a plan suggested by MLB last winter to shrink the minor leagues. Major League Baseball had already floated the idea of cutting about 25% of minor league teams last winter.
And is that because the minor leagues aren't profitable, or what's behind the desire to want to cut them?
Yeah, so it was very controversial. Because the minor league system dates back to the 1920s. And there's been a large minor league system for a very long time, but you have new people in management who are new age management people instead of traditional baseball people. And a lot of those new age management people were looking at profit margins and deciding that, you know what, we think we can trim the minor league system a little bit and still develop our major league players and not have to pay as many minor leaguers, even though we're paying them, you know, pennies on the dollar. And so that line of thinking was really persuasive at the upper levels of Major League Baseball, and so this idea was floated. And it appears that since the pandemic hit, that idea has gotten much, much more traction. And it appears that next year, my guess is the minor league system will be smaller than it has been probably since the 1920s.
So just rounding out that idea and sort of as we close out the segment here, I mean, what does that look like for the future of minor league baseball? It's obviously going to be smaller, but is there a future for minor league baseball after the coronavirus?
Well, yeah, there is, but yeah, we don't know exactly what shape it's going to take. I would hope that reasonable minds will prevail. There are still a lot of good people in baseball that want to do the right thing. Those at the top aren't always listening to them right now. But, you know, I would hope that those better minds still have sway. And what I think will happen, I think we'll still have minor league baseball next year. Hopefully, it will still be a pretty large system, and there will still be a number of guys that get an opportunity because, you know, these guys are the future of Major League Baseball. The Major League teams also need the minor league system because, you know, unlike the NBA, unlike the NFL, Major League Baseball signs players as young as 16. A lot of the Dominican players, a lot of the Venezuelan players that they sign are 16 and 17 years old, and it takes them several years to develop. And so, you know, the minor league system is truly needed for developmental purposes. Even for American guys, they sign high school players at age 18, and they simply aren't ready for the major leagues yet. And then also there's the cultural aspect of it. You know, some of these towns that have minor league baseball teams have had those teams for 100 years. It's a matter of civic pride for them. It's a matter of entertainment. It's a matter of being able to go to those games and see those prospects play and see future major leaguers play. And it's a matter of introducing new generations to baseball. And so, you know, I hope that is preserved, and, you know, I'm optimistic that it will be. But, you know, last week was certainly a dark week for baseball.
Garrett Brushhouse is an attorney for ballplayers and a former San Francisco Giants minor leaguer. Garrett, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. As always, you can feel free to give us a call and share your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.